I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is YouTube personality and blogger Morgoth. Morgoth, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having us, Greg. I've been a fan of the Countercurrents for a long time, but I think we'll get into that later on. Had a bit of big effect on me.
Well, that is exciting. I would like to definitely dig into that some more. The purpose of having this conversation is just to get to know you better and to introduce you to my audience, to my readership. I have been following you for the last few years largely because of millennial woes. Woes is constantly saying, oh, look at Morgoth's take on this or that. So I've gone to your blog. I have done a live stream with you. I did that last year. I follow you on Twitter. I see you when you come on things like Millennial. And I thought, well, I don't know the guy very well, though. I'd like to know more. I have questions. So can you tell me a bit about where you're from? Judging from your accent, to an American, you sound like you're either from Scotland or the north of England. So can you tell me first where you're from, and then we can just go from there?
Yeah, I'm from the north of England, the northeast of England. And it is quite a distinctive accent. It's why I didn't want to do YouTube for a long time, because I thought people are not used to hearing that. There's a sort of that class thing among the English, I think, where only people who speak the crystal glass style English get to speak on our platform. But it goes down quite well. Well, then the northeast of England is one of the poorest areas of England. But it's also one of the ones where we've kind of, since Thatcher closed the mains, we've kind of just been left to get on with things. We haven't really had much in the way of multiculturalism. There's some around Newcastle, but when you get out into Northumberland, which is the huge stretch between where Newcastle ends, and then there's a large stretch of moorland and hills and really quite barren countryside, and then you end up hitting Scotland, and it's as if we just got forgotten about for a long time. I think it tends to make people very politically incorrect in this part of the world, because people aren't going through universities, and when you are kind of just left alone, you're not that conscious of what all the changing wars are. There was an article in the Daily Mail about 10 years ago said that we were 30 years behind like the rest of the values of the country, which it suits me. It suits me very well.
One of the good things about alternative media, of course, is you can just set yourself up as a pundit. You can speak. You don't have to go through the filters of the BBC and the British class system and so forth. And so I'm very, very glad about that. That's just another example of why these alternative media platforms have been so freeing. So how would you describe your intellectual and political outlook, your philosophy?
It kind of evolves. It still is. I've become a lot more philosophical over the last 18 months or so. But a standard white nationalist talking points has been my stock and trade for a long time. And so, I mean, when you make them a little bit more sophisticated than what people are used to, I kind of got tired of the alt-right craze, where it was always a sort of expose of Jewish power, and I wanted to get beyond that. And then I began to read, and I began to discover people like Heidegger and Spengler, a lot of the stuff on Countercurrents. And I like the way it changed your frame. And then you can apply that back on the trends of the day and have a bit more nuance. I just put a video before, for example, we've got another grooming scandal that's broke in England, and it's each time the bubbles, the boil under the pan lid is getting worse and worse. And I called it a system of lies. And I wanted to, so that I think that many of the people on right-wing British circles would say it's just political correctness, and they're cowards because the people in the police, the councillors, the local politicians, and they're cowards, and that's as far as they'll go. And I thought, well, really, why is it, when you see what they said, if the truth gets out in places like Rotherham, they said the town would erupt and melt down into violence. Now, I thought that was an interesting thing because it's based on an assumption that the natural state of man is tribal, and that's like an illiberal worldview. So they kind of concede that it's a tinderbox that they've created, but they're still going to celebrate it at the same time. And it occurred to me that really what they were doing was lying to cover up the cracks and the contradictions and the paradoxes at the heart of the multicultural society. It can only be sustained by lies. And in the case of the grooming issue, they've had to make a, if they conceded, it was like conceding that the whole project was a sham. So instead, they've lied and let tens of thousands of English girls go through the meat grinder. And so I thought when you dig into it and you can go bore down and get into the nuts and bolts of it, and I think people enjoy that. And I do okay. I get quite a lot of views, I think, on YouTube for that kind of content. And rather than just what a lot of people do is go on Twitter, see what's trending, and then pump out 10 minutes of content, especially the centrists do that. But they're just, that's to me is an echo chamber, because they're not really pushing the boundaries. They're feeding back to people what they already know.
So Morgoth is a term that comes out of Tolkien. Can you explain why you chose the name Morgoth's Review for your YouTube channel?
I started out on the Daily Telegraph. Guest worker from Majority Rights was there. And for about a year or so, for whatever reason, the Daily Telegraph had a comment section, a blog section, and then they had comments underneath. And for whatever reason, they just had no moderation at all. Threats of violence and things would be removed, but you could really get into some heavy-duty stuff about Jewish power or about race, lots of other very controversial things, and there was just no moderation. It was all allowed, but eventually it didn't last. But for about a stretch of a year, it became this hotbed of far-right British activity, nationalists all under the hugging the comments boards and having serious discussions. That's where Millennial Wars, I first came across Millennial Wars. So there was quite a few characters came out of that. And eventually when they did start banning people, I had to have a running theme. And so I had a running theme of Tolkien-esque names. And so when I came back, people would know it was me. And I went through about 40 different Tolkien-style names. And eventually I just got sick and tired of being banned. And I decided to open a blog. And the one that I was using when I did eventually get fed up with being banned was Morgoth. And I read Countercurrents, and I used to love the movie reviews, and I decided that I'm going to open my own blog and I can't be banned, but I'm also going to have my focus is going to be on movies and pop culture and quick takes of the news of the day, but from a white nationalist perspective. One of the things I didn't like about the, especially the British scene, was that it was all this sort of Enoch Powell Spitfires and Bulldogs and all of this like old, it looked like going to your granny's house on a Sunday. There was all of this old fashioned British patriotism. You would see that all over the nationalist scene. And I didn't like that at all. I thought it was stale and boring. And I wanted to have my blog was, and all of the banners that we designed, people used to send them in. And I mixed it so that when you looked at it, it looked like a sort of sci-fi fantasy, sort of a nerd site. But it really did look like that. And it was called Morgoth's Review. But the actual content was like pure white nationalism mixed in with movie reviews and stuff. And so that this was actually something that I picked up on Countercurrents way back, around about the same time, actually, maybe a few years before. And then I realized that mixing up pop culture with hard right white nationalist opinions and stuff was brilliant. I really loved it, and it was so fresh, and you can kind of wedge your talking points in there and jam the system, and I did it quite a lot. And I still do it on the YouTube channel, but you just can't get away with that much on YouTube.
You are actually called by some people now King Hobbit. How did that happen?
It's popped up recently. Me and Keith Woods have had a lot of back and forths with libertarians. And it comes down to a lot of me content over the last year. I wanted to get away from the misery porn of the... I've slipped back into it over the last week or so, but it's, you know, the grooming issue. But I wanted to look at the... I was interested in the Eternal Anglo meme and the implications of the Eternal Anglo meme, because I couldn't actually fault it. And I didn't like it. And there's a lot of... I didn't like it because it acts like a sort of white guilt 2.0 on English nationalists in particular. Well, and it's actually caused quite a lot of trouble. And I wanted to explore it and dig into it. And one of the things that I've been exploring on the YouTube channel is whether there is a different, exploring a frame of reference outside of the usual Anglo empiricism and drive after money. And so I'll go fishing, and I'll have the rod sitting there, and I'll do a video on it. Or, I mean, I did a video last week where I went for a walk through the woods with me dog, and there was a wall along a little stream. I saw a wall, and I couldn't help but notice there was the wall had been there for so long that there was a huge tree growing out of it. And so all of these things point to something outside of just money and the usual materialism which the Anglos get accused of. And I want to try and change that as well. The idea, for example, of the Labour Party, the Jeremy Corbyn had a plan. I mean, the whole Labour manifesto was insane, but he had a plan where they were going to plant something like 12 billion trees. It was absolutely extraordinary. And I thought, well, you know, that is, that's fair enough. If I was like God Emperor of England, I'd actually do something like that. We could get everybody to work terraforming England into a more idealized form, into something which is genuinely beautiful. But we don't talk in terms of 12 billion trees. We talk of foresting the land again. And I also said that I would turn London into a giant lake, which triggered a few of the Southerners. And so again, it is this. I've done videos on leaving aside issues of race and culture and stuff. It's just England just doesn't have the space for all of the housing. We're losing. It's just going to turn into one giant slab of concrete. And so I do videos on that as well. Just trying to dig in a little bit and go beyond the normal talking points. And of course, some people will say that I do have an attitude where I just really want to pull a giant shield, get rid of all the coloureds and pull a giant shield over England and live as King Hobbit on the Shire. You have other people who are saying you're too reactionary and you're too inward looking. And what we really need to be doing is talking in terms of this European expansive empire. And I think, well, that may all well be well and good. The problem is, what's it going to be based on? What is its founding on philosophy going to be? Because otherwise we're just going to carry on into the sea. We're going to carry on as we are now, except we're going to have an empire. I think we need to get the basics right and the foundations right. So that's the kind of things that I've been interested in.
Tolkien is a huge influence in our sphere generally, I think. I think it's very important because Tolkien has a kind of green-rooted nationalism that I think is a alternative to the kind of modern Anglo-capitalist empiricist mentality. And the thing is, that's very, very authentically English. It's very, very authentic. Well, it feels authentic to Northern Europeans in general, I think. We've got to find things in our own homelands, in our own traditions that are healthy and try and tend those. And Tolkienism is a very powerful thing, just as a realm of symbols. It really reaches our people. And so to cultivate that as an alternative to the dark satanic mills of capitalism, I think that's very, very healthy. Because the last thing we want to be, if we're going to engage in ethno-nationalism and identity politics, is to do it in a fake way, in an inauthentic way. That sort of defeats the whole purpose.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, one of the popular videos I did this year was there was a there's a in London there's a music station called Classic FM, and they've got all of these really hip, really PC radio stations in London, and it turns out that Classic FM, the amount of listeners that they were getting just skyrocketed. It went through the roof over the last 18 months to 2 years. And they broke down the demographics. Well, they didn't break down in race terms, but in age, it was young people, and they were stretching up into sort of the 40s. But it wasn't what you expect, because normally you'd expect classic music to just be for like rich old white people. In actual fact, my I thought that was interesting, because that's actually Europeans. That's the white population, or just can't stand the sort of the drudge of the plastic pop music, and how they've become alienated from it, and they've then gravitated back. Or subconsciously, without thinking about it, to another form which speaks to them. And when I was putting the ideas for the video together, I knew I was preempting, in a way, a challenge in the comments, which would be to say, does that mean they're all heading back towards, are they going to all turn into racist nationalists or whatever? And no, I don't think so, because what I really found interesting about it was that most of them would probably have been liberals. Most of them would have maybe on the left, but their politics and their right on PC opinions is actually quite shallow. They're deeper. What they're doing is, without thinking about it, moving back to listen to Classic FM because they can't get away from their Europeanness, even if they know how to mouth out the platitudes of political correctness. So the identity is deeper than that. And I thought that I really like that kind of thinking, and so that's what I've been trying to get into a lot. There was a little vi I went for a walk with the dog, and I came across a little bridge. I went through for a walk through the woods, and I came across a little bridge, and it was I thought, why build that? And it would have been the council, but it was a little bridge over a little ravine in the middle of nowhere. And then they had done so much work on this path along this steep hillside. And I thought the amount of man-hours and the amount of work which has gone into that, and it's for no productive purpose whatsoever. It's only so people can have nice walks through the woods. They've pumped hundreds of man-hours into this very pretty little bridge and this pretty little walkway, this path, for no other reason than people like to walk through the woods. And I think, do other people do that? I think the Japanese and maybe the Chinese will do that. But again, I think there's something very European to that. That this ideal, this searching for something more, this being in the countryside, in nature. And yeah, so that it is whimsy. And I think the English do have that. Because in the modern world, it's very hard, where everything's about money and production and profits, efficiency. There's that little bridge and that path doesn't really have a place at all, and yet it still does exist. And to ask why is an interesting question, I think.
Yeah, I think that is interesting. It brings to mind a whole side of the English character that in the late 19th century, you had movements that were consciously opposed to capitalism and a kind of utilitarian mentality. I'm thinking of things like the arts and crafts movement, which was very much interested in old Nordic literature. You had aestheticism. You had somebody like Oscar Wilde. One of his aphorisms, I wish I could quote it exactly, is so beautiful. He says, "It's a pity that there's so little useless knowledge these days."
Yeah.
It's supposed to shock the utilitarian mentality, but of course, the whole point of the liberal arts and anything fine and beautiful is to get outside this attitude that things have to be useful for some purpose. Liberal arts mean liberated from economic necessity, liberated from utility. And it's sad that you go to a university today and there's almost no useless knowledge. It's almost all vocational and technical. And it's only gotten worse since Oscar Wilde was around. Aestheticism, just the idea that the most important thing is not utility, but beauty. I think that that is very much part of the counter tradition that we can tap into. And yes, it is sort of beyond left and right. People like William Morris thought of themselves as socialists and radicals. And yet today, because they had this cult of beauty, they seem incredibly reactionary, especially by the standards of modern art. So I think that getting in touch with all those counter traditions is a really healthy thing. We're talking about popular music. One thing that I try to do at Countercurrents is get articles that talk about the whiteness of a lot of popular music, but I don't pay much attention to what's on the radio these days, except when I would take an Uber. And almost invariably, I would get into an Uber and they'd be playing this contemporary urban pop music that, for one thing, was incredibly infantile. It just sounded like baby talk babbling, and in accents that were not European, and voices that were not European. It was just profoundly alien. And I got to the point where I would often just ask an Uber driver, could you put on a different station? And they would often do it. They were good sports about it. I got to the point where if I got into an Uber and the person were playing classical music or jazz, I would actually give them a tip.
Yeah.
And thank them for playing.
I work in factories, and some of the radio stations are so bad. There's one called, I mean, this is why the people have become alienated, is mainly through one station called Capital FM, but everybody calls it Crapital FM. And they've got a playlist, and it will be that childish, infantile rubbish. But they'll only have six songs on in an hour, and then it just repeats. And if you're working in a factory or a warehouse or somewhere, and if you're there for, say, 9 hours in the daytime, it drives you mad. It drives you absolutely mad. And I did one video on Ed Sheeran, where I kind of broke down how many times a week I would be subjected to a song, something like 120 times a week. And it has this deadening effect on you. And it's funny the way they have, where there's nothing like, I mean, even in the 90s, you can see that something like Oasis had a whiteness to it, which is gone, completely gone from pop scene now. And it does, as I mean, it's funny because we're discussing this. Roger Scruton was maybe the last conservative who valued beauty, and he died just last week. And he actually spoke quite a lot about pop music, and he called it a soft carpet of noise in the background of modern life, which is also true. But I think a band like Radiohead is an interesting one as well, because they are lefties. They do, you know, they're for the refugees' welcome. But again, when you listen to Radiohead's music, there's a very European angst in there, and their audience must be like 99% white.
I would imagine so. Yeah, I agree with that completely. I wanted to ask you about Roger Scruton because you have done a couple of videos about him. He was an influence on me. He was a wonderful writer on art and beauty. He wrote a couple of books on the aesthetics of architecture that I've read, several books in the aesthetics of music, including a book just called The Aesthetics of Music. And I was remembering in particular his analysis of this REM song, Losing My Religion, which I always thought was incredibly banal. And he just really, really nailed how banal that particular song was. He didn't really appreciate popular music to the extent that I think it can be appreciated. And I do want to appropriate a lot of it and make it, part of our tradition, because it is. It's part of our life. There has to be a little bit of a kind of ethnic pushback, I think, in popular music, because the tendency has been to constantly accelerate the sort of multiculturalization of pop music. And I know it was record companies that were trying to constantly force black music on, especially Anglo-white pop. From the 70s and the 80s on.
Yeah, one of the things you can notice, there's a great YouTube video where he breaks this down. It's not really political, but he does break down about how pop music's changed, and they've actually got it with empirical evidence, and they've used scientific methods, and he compares some of the more modern pop to Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club. I'm not the biggest Beatles fan, but the range of melodies and instruments in it is, and the difference between then and now, it's there. You can see it on paper. It's the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club is like a whale of noise. There's just lines all over, melodies all over this graph, and then you get like Nicki Minaj, and there's just two sad little lines going across the thing. Another thing they've done is they used to happen where the standard sort of pop song setup, where they've changed it because you've got so many teenage girls downloading music on their phones, and they want the hook, the catch of the song has to kick in within 25 seconds or something, otherwise they'll just swipe it and move on to the next song. So the Nicki Minaj is the perfect one for that. Whereas if you listen to a half decent pop song, say from the 90s when I think it was at its peak in Britain, then you actually see that the payoff does come very late into the song. After the third stanza, then you'll get the emotional payoff in the song. But now they've completely changed pop songs, and they've brought the payoff to being like 20 seconds in, and then it just repeats itself for 3 minutes and finishes. In Britain, we do they have because now that they've got digital, and it's actually quite it's much easier to set up a radio station, and you see things like Absolute 90s. And there's a one called that I got them to switch it on at work, which is called Union Jack. And it really is, they may as well just call it Radio Station White. And they've done it so that you send a text message in as to what song you want next. So it's for people driving taxis, working at a hospital or whatever. And then it's the audience decides the playlist. And it's just all white rock bands, really, all day. There's almost no black music in there. I mean, I think Thin Lizzy was on there quite a bit with Whiskey in the Jar, and that you had a black Irishman there. Back when having a black Irishman was a novelty, and that was kind of the only look in they got. And again, it's interesting because this is subconscious. They're not doing it to be racist. This is just natural behavior, without thinking about it. It's when they have to stop and process this and how it affects the rest of the world, their whiteness, as it gets called now. It is there. It is a thing, but just not in the way the Marxists think.
Tell me a bit about your thoughts on Roger Scruton.
I didn't really come across him that much. I remember I used to pillory that particular brand of conservative. And there's a picture of Roger Scruton surrounded by, he's in like an inner city London. This is four or five years ago, and he's surrounded with like black kids, basically. And I used to pillory that, because I used to think, like, this is where you ended up. Like, what use is your conservatism if it results in that? And you've got to stand there with a face, like you've lost on all fronts if you've ended up. Now, as I've kind of matured, I've become much more susceptible to that, the aesthetics and the ideals and ideas of beauty and art. So I'm a lot friendlier towards them now than I would have been a few years ago, funny enough.
Yeah, I think the nicest thing he did for England probably was standing up against ugly architecture, because that really has a very direct effect on a lot of people. That is really where I think aesthetics impacts people's lives most, because most people feel like rats in hideous, brutalist concrete mazes. It grinds down the soul. It's soul-killing. And he stood up against modern architecture and had some influence on public policy and certainly got a public debate going about this in a way that I can't think of any other person on the right ever succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I got into a discussion about this a couple of weeks back, which is what is the worst between brutalism, and we had a lot of it in the north of England and in Scotland as well. Some of it's still around. Just these giant monolithic slabs of concrete, or the more modern ones, which you see today, which is all just glass, and it's all kind of see through and airy, the way the buildings that are going up now are like that. And I wonder, like, what is the worst of it? Because the brutalism lets you know you're in a totalitarian state. It's right there in front of your face. You feel small. You feel intimidated. And the more that I don't know what style you'd call it, maybe postmodern, but the glass and steel, like the Sage, I think it is, in London is one, an example. Like it's just this huge sort of glass bubble. And it's funny because it's a negation of anything solid. It's more worrisome than the brutalism, which would just oppress you out front. The now, it's kind of like, well, there's nothing there. There's no structure to anything.
I want to talk a bit about the recent UK general election, because it was a wonderful surprise to me. It really was the second Brexit referendum that the left was screaming for, and they lost again. They lost massively. And there was a real shift, including in your part of England, away from Labour towards the Tories. Do you want to comment a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, in the north, especially in the northeast, where I am, was key. What they called it was Labour's Red Wall. And it was a play on words, because we've got the Roman Wall, which is Hadrian's Wall, and then the colour, obviously, of Labour is red. And they would call the northeast was the Labour heartlands, which would vote Labour no matter what, mainly because the people up here hate the Tories because of Thatcher closing down the mines and stripping the place of the heavy industry in the 80s. And so it's been a very heavy Labour, they call it the wall. And what we saw was that the wall did actually come down. And I'm happy to say I played my own small role in that. I voted for Brexit Party. I couldn't bear to just vote for the Conservatives. But at any rate, it wasn't a vote that went to Labour. And I did a video on why that was. And I think I think it had been simmering away under the surface for a long time, and Labour just pushed it too far, where people now began to see that it wasn't that the people in London, which is quite a distance from up here, that Labour were pandering to the minorities and the middle class London set, and openly despising working class white people. And then on top of that, you've got the issue of the grooming gangs, which everybody knows about in working class circles. It's just that they're ignored when they speak out about it and dismissed as racists and bigots and Islamophobes and all the rest of it. And I think it finally dawned on the people of the North, the working class people, that the Labour Party weren't just aloof and a bunch of champagne lovies, that they were actually at war with them. And there's a big distinction there. It wasn't just that they were being left alone, and people actually began to be scared of the prospect of Labour getting in, because it would mean what they, quite rightly, to be honest, they see the Labour Party as being the party of Islam, and so people do openly criticize Islam and Muslims on the streets and in their workplaces and things like that. Islam isn't this taboo as talking about racial differences or Jewish power or these kinds of things. It's kind of fallen into the realm to be discussed. And so from the perspective of the white working class, the Labour Party was going to side with Muslims against them, that Labour was actually at war with them. And they had things like Rotherham to back it up, and the terrorist attacks. I mean, they just saw reality and voted the other way. And it was this sneering contempt that the London set has had for them forever. And the effects of that on Labour are catastrophic, because that they had any kind of electoral success at all in recent years was mainly down to working class white apathy and ignorance. You know, I'm not going to dress it up. It was a major issue that so many working class white people in the North were still voting Labour despite everything. And we finally managed to get through to them, and it ended. And when you saw what Labour was left with, and Labour actually thought they could win this election. This was catastrophic for Labour. They did not see this coming, and so then the problem they've got is, you know, they're still arguing about it in the Guardian opinion section every day now. Is if they you've got some people in the Labour Party, it's possible the Labour Party itself splits in two. And there's a new thing called Blue Labour, which is perhaps socially conservative, but then also socialist on the economics. So they've got a lot of problems going on. But I think, assuming Labour manages to hold together, the problem that they've still got is that if anybody in the Labour Party says we need to reach out to the white working class communities in the North, they're instantly shot down by all of the ethnic minorities, because they're going to say, well, no, the whites are the enemy. So this is the bed that, like, the left across the West has made for itself. And the only thing they can do is wait for the demographics to kick in. Because if you have a look at where they did manage to hold on, it was mainly Muslim areas in Yorkshire, and then like London and Birmingham, where there's all kinds of minorities, non-whites.
That's really interesting. I looked at the results, and my take on it was that Britain voted for national populism. They liked Boris Johnson because he was going to get Brexit done, which represented a nationalist and populist platform. And he also said, we're going to make sure that the National Health Service is well-funded. This was a break from the kind of Republican free market stuff that's dominant in the United States, unfortunately. And I also thought that the fact that the Scottish National Party did well was, again, a sign that people are voting for the more nationalist and populist options if they have them. Do you think that Scottish independence would be a good thing for Scotland or a good thing for England?
Well, as the quintessential little Englander, I'd be quite happy with that because it's just another layer of bureaucracy gone, and it whittles England down once more to a more manageable size. For the Scottish themselves, I mean, there's nothing nationalist about the SNP. They're just like Scottish Labour, really. But then they'd be in the European Union, and you would have England surrounded by the European Union. But some people are saying that, you know, the Scots are pinning their hopes. Scottish independence is pinned on the idea that they can go independent from England and then join the European Union and be, you know, become part of that club. A lot of people are saying that they might not actually be, you know, the European Union might not actually take them. So I don't know. I find Scottish politics to be very boring, actually. I think they've got this Europeanness to them, like somewhere like Holland or Denmark, where it seems very tame and stale, and there's not much going on there. There's not much stirring, except that they want independence from England, but only because, you know, this weird dialectic where that is to be edgy. The sort of old school Tory toffs are the enemies to be fought, and it's similar to the Irish mentality as well, and I don't think it gets them anywhere in the modern age, actually.
The Scottish National Party is a great example of left-wing nationalism. And if they did get independence, though, I think what would happen in Scotland would be like what happens in every other country. Suddenly, they'd have to have a Scottish left, a Scottish right, and a Scottish center. And there would be debates about the direction to go in and so forth. And so if the Scottish National Party thinks that they can become independent and then they'll simply rule the roost, I think that's certainly a delusional view. But my hope is that if Scotland breaks away, they would become more of a normal country. They'd have their own, again, their own political spectrum, their own political debates. They could start basically figuring out what's right for Scotland rather than just formulating policies based on wanting to piss off the English, which is a part, definitely it's a part of the current situation. And one of the things that was most devastating for Labour in this last election was how many Labour voters went to the Scottish National Party. And if Scotland left the UK, would the British Labour Party ever get anywhere close to power again?
No. They'd be finished, I think. I think I don't see how they could, unless they just sat tight and waited for the demographics to reach such a tipping point that there was no coming back for it. But when we're in England, things are bad, but we're not in that situation yet. I think they've made a mistake on that count, and it was all relying on the white working class just sheepishly going along and voting for Labour, and they don't seem to have a plan B. The plan B is just sit and wait for the demographics to kick in. And another thing is that it did break that paradigm as well. It did shift the cycle. And so if you went on the Twitter accounts of Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson during the campaign, Jeremy Corbyn had to tick so many boxes, and it was, we're going to protect the Muslims. And then he had all of the Jews going after him. They wanted rid of him. And then he was having to have special seminars and special meetings with black people and all of these boxes, the LGBT agenda. And it just got so convoluted and so, and of course, nothing ever, no kind of outreach for their main base of support. Whereas when you saw the Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party, it was a very simple message, and it was just, let's get Brexit done, with a British flag in the background. Now, It's simplistic, but it works. I do think as well that what it's funny because we're talking about the Eternal Anglo, and I think the Conservative Party is a very, very well organized and professional machine, and they knew just keep the message simple and keep repeating it over and over again. And then you go look at the identity politics and how complicated things are for Labour. It was just so easy, and that would have been thought out beforehand. And I think what's another thing that's happening with Labour is that the diversity hires are now really beginning to kick in, and that they're not even able to get a decent cohesive strategy out because the people who are devising the strategies are, black feminists or whatever. And when the Tories, the Conservatives, I mean, then we have nothing but contempt for these sellouts and stuff. But just to look at their in organization, even they have, I think she's a Home Secretary, so they do have the diversity in there. And one of them's this, you can tell she's been like a high caste Indian called Priti Patel. And so even their diversity are like very high IQ and capable people. Whereas you look at what Labour have got, and it's a complete shambles. It's people who have got really heavy Pakistani and Jamaican accents and have got no knowledge of what they're doing whatsoever. And so, and then you've got the other, just a straightforward fact that the backbone of the Tory party is the are these well-educated, highly capable white men from Eton and Cambridge and Oxford and things like that. So they're able to outthink the Labour Party on top of all of the other problems that the Labour Party have to deal with. And it's an interesting dynamic in that way.
Do you think these smart people from Eton and Oxford are going to get enough spine, enough courage to actually say, okay, we need to undo this social engineering experiment that was put in place, especially by Tony Blair, with the express purpose of basically replacing white British voters with non-whites to try and create a permanent leftist majority? Do you think that they will say, okay, this was a clear attempt to steal votes, a clear attempt to dispossess the electorate and replace them with some keelots who would vote for this establishment party, this left-wing elite, this hostile leftist elite? Do you think they will ever basically say, let's undo this terrible thing that's been done?
No, I don't think they could either. That we're hamstrung by all kinds of agreements and protocols and human rights agreements. I don't. What they tend to do is they think they can solve everything with economics. That's how they look at it. It's just the complete opposite world vision as Roger Scruton had. It's a purely utilitarian. Everything can be whittled down to economic. It's the same as the Republican Party. Well, and so you end up in the same kind of depressing situation is emerging in Britain as you have in America, where you're going to have the white working class voting for people who are just going to sort of pay lip service to helping them out, but it's mainly just because the white people are becoming increasingly terrified of the party of diversity on the left. I mean, even the grooming gangs issue is an interesting one because it does appear that for whatever reason, the grooming was an issue in Labour-run areas and not in Conservative areas. You'd think it's too that wouldn't matter on the ground, but it does seem to be the case, and I cannot explain why.
That's really actually rather terrifying. I'm glad in a way that it wasn't happening everywhere, but that it would be so organically connected to labor strongholds. That really demands some kind of inquest
So
into that party.
this is what the Tory party could do. I mean, I've been a bit angry about this and I did a live stream the other night. And I was, my point on this was to say, look, let's use this as a wedge issue, because, you know, in the sort of edgy right wing circles on the internet, everybody's, all you ever say is mass deportations. And I'm thinking, well, okay, but that's point D. We're still at point A. Why don't we say, last year it came out that there was 19,000 English girls reported as being groomed. The Independent released it. So let's just start off with the basic thing here. We need to stop this abuse from happening.
Yeah.
How are we? Let's just, you know, let's not get carried away with deportations and ethno states and all of that. Let's just start at point A here. This abuse needs to stop. And the only way we can really get it to stop is if these men are physically removed from the areas where these girls live. Now, I don't know how we're going to do that. Maybe you put them on a tag. Maybe you corral them into already heavily Islamified areas like Bradford. We can work that out. Let's establish the principle that this needs to happen to stop the abuse. And then we can move on from there. And further down the line, if you achieve that first goal, further down the line, you do actually end up where, I would also say, you don't even have to include Muslim women or anything, because we know the ethnicity of the worst offenders, the biggest problem groups. We know who they are. We know where they're coming from. Places like Afghanistan, almost always Pakistan, Somalia, these kinds of places, these paradises. And it seems to me that if we can get into the discourse and the idea that, look, we understand we're living in a liberal society, okay, but this needs to stop. And the only way you can make it stop is to separate these men from these girls. And then further down the line that's what I was going to say. You could also just say, we're not interested in moving women. Let's say all men between 15 and 60 who are from Pakistan have to be away from white girls after 7 o'clock at night or something like that. It would be a start. Instead of this all or nothing attitude which dominates the right, because I think it's in a bit of a way it's a cope so that you don't actually have to push for a certain straightforward position. Because further down the line, you would have a concentration of all of the worst elements in one particular place.
Right. Well, the first thing to do is simply arrest everybody who's actually doing this and put them in jail, put all the people who enable them in jail, and then you start figuring out ways of deporting them. You come up with deals where they do their time in Pakistan. It'd probably be a lot cheaper to outsource jailing to Pakistan, and then they stay there once they're released. And then you let family reunification work for us for a change. Instead of a chain migration scheme, have a chain emigration scheme for the purposes of reuniting these people with their families back in their homelands. And of course, you could always just say, look, these are the problem countries. No more immigration whatsoever from these countries. We're deep in a hole. If you're in a hole, stop digging. So you're in a flooding basement. your basement's being flooded with rapists, you know. You turn off the spigot, right? And then you start trying to mop up the mess. So I think that those would be incremental kinds of changes that you could make that would definitely improve things. And who knows, once people actually get a feeling that something is being done to protect them and their children, and done to secure not only their safety, but a future for their people more broadly, they might get addicted to it and want even more. But I think that we can do all of this in an incremental way. But yeah, going after the grooming thing should be the way to do it, because it is the most heinous thing. And it doesn't just convict the rapists. It convicts the whole left political establishment that enables them.
Yeah, yeah.
And it convicts the conservatives for being such cowards that they go along with this. It's when I first heard about Rotherham, I just thought, oh my God, and because the same cause gives rise to the same effect. So it wasn't just happening in Rotherham. It had to be happening wherever these people are. And the sheer scale of it was just horrifying when I started thinking that way. And I just thought Enoch Powell would have predicted streets red with blood if something like this came out. And it hasn't happened. And it really is a powerful issue that I think can be exploited, not in a cheap and demagogic way, but in a very focused way, to just bring a halt to this and problem and then reverse it and impeach the entire political establishment that made it possible.
Yeah, I describe it on my video I did, my analysis video about why Labour lost a few weeks ago. But it's as if the liberal establishment, the grooming issue on the liberal establishment, is like one of those blow darts where you get struck with the dart, but you don't just drop dead. And instead, there's like poisons and toxins go into the body. And this is what's happening to the political establishment on the grooming issue. They'll deal with a terrorist attack. They roll out PR companies and hashtags on Twitter, and they set a tone in a certain line and tart it up a little bit. We all stand together. No, don't give in to hate and all of that kind of thing. They can't do it with the grooming issue because it's as if they've just been shot with this poison, which is just gradually edging its way through the system and the organs of the liberal establishment. And they think if they can just remain aloof and mouth out a few platitudes here and there, it's going to go away. And it isn't. It hasn't. It's just getting worse and worse. If I speak about these things on some of the live streams I do, which can get a little bit rowdy and stuff, I've actually got to say, remember these things, they affect white men in a certain way. Remember what you're writing on the internet. Keep calm. I understand how bad this affects you. You've got to be like a sort of counselor, because I got sent a video by a Pakistani. We didn't get into my awakening kind of thing, but one of the things that did happen was about 10 years ago on Facebook, when I still lived in Europe, and I was arguing with some leftists. So I was just waking up, and the BNP were doing well, and there was a lot going on. And a Pakistani sent me a video which played automatically, which was like a video taking of what they were actually doing, and they were doing power salutes in the air as they were doing it. And I was traumatized that forever. That was when I went full... Because that was when I decided that I wanted to dedicate myself to rooting these people out and to ending this and to winning this struggle.
Well, that's really a powerful way, I think, to end. We've been going on for a little bit more than an hour, and I want to keep this very manageable. So, Morgoth, thank you so much. Let's definitely do another conversation, either here at Countercurrents Radio or maybe a live stream or another video at your place. I'd love to talk more about movies and music and art and also politics too.
June, we definitely need to get into June. I'm not which comes out this year. Do you think it's going to be a good one?
I don't know. I hope it'll be good. I think the director is a very talented director. I wasn't terribly impressed with Blade Runner 2049. I wish it was a better movie. I liked his earlier movies quite a lot. The casting, I'm upset about a lot of the casting decisions that they made, but I think it could be very, very good. I hope it's very good. I have my own vision of how this should be done, and I'm pretty sure it won't be done that way. So it's going to be a hard sell. But yeah, Dune is one of my favorite books.
Yeah, I love it too.
Yeah, I've gotten in the habit of reading it about once a year now. And so I've got some very strong opinions about how to do that. And I think it could be a very, very good movie. I hope it will be good because it's a great book. And it's one of our books. Frank Herbert really is one of our guys, I think, certainly more than liberal Democrat. And I would love to see this done in the right spirit, because I think it could be very powerful just culturally.
Yep. Yeah, so definitely you can come on my channel and we'll dig it. We'll talk about some pop culture stuff. Yeah, that'll be great.
Well, great. I've really enjoyed this again. So let people know how they can watch your videos, read your blog, follow you on Twitter, and so forth.
I'm Morgoth's Review on YouTube, BitChute, which is a up and coming thing. I've got high hopes for that. And Morgoth's Review on my blog. And just on Google, you'll find me.
Well, thank you so much, and we will definitely talk again.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for listening, folks.